It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right.
I suppose you don't want to hear any barnyard humor, do you?
Or no, sounds.
We're saving that for our Christmas special. sorry to disappoint. So, you managed to make it in here.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Pretty amazing, actually.
Well, with all the sales going on and stuff, I know I'm exhausted. All right, let's start out.
I've been up for 28 hours. That sounds like it, doesn't it?
Actually, that sounds about right. Let's start out with our one local item. Otherwise, it's all national and international this week. Starting out with Washington State.
Yeah, it's been a slow week for news locally. A lot of people off on vacation, but it is your chance on vacation to meet one Daryl Stenson, you might want to meet Daryl Stenson this week because, well, next week you might not be able to. Daryl Stenson is a guy who made the unfortunate choice a few years ago in 1994 of murdering a couple people in Clallam County. And as a result, he is scheduled for execution on December 3rd. He would be the first inmate to be executed in Washington State since 2001. There are a couple of stays in place that would delay the execution. The state at this point is appealing those. And, of course, Christine Gregoire has the power as well to commute his sentence to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The death penalty is making a little bit of a comeback in Washington State. Dan Satterberg, the new prosecutor for King County, has decided to seek the death penalty in the case last year of the Carnation couple that massacred their family, Michelle Anderson and Joseph McEnroe. That case is going to be a death penalty case as well. And it really raises the question at this point, with so many states engaging in moratoriums on the death penalty, looking at the fairness of it, the fact that it's incredibly costly to prosecute a death penalty case because of all the appeals and the hoops and the standards of evidence the prosecuting team has to meet,
It doesn't serve any useful purpose as a deterrent.
No, it doesn't serve a useful purpose as a deterrent. And if you want to send a message that killing people is wrong, it's generally a good idea not to do that by killing people. So
yeah. It might be helpful to start at the top with, say, our president. Getting him to agree that killing people is wrong.
Yeah, Obama is in fact a supporter of the death penalty, as is Christine Gregoire. It will be useful in this case for people who are...
I noticed you didn't say George Bush.
Yes.
He said Obama. Anyway, go on.
Yes, well, Obama, or rather Bush, Bush has always been kind of lukewarm toward the death penalty. He prefers slow torture.
No, I'm talking about the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism and all the many, many ways that our government is engaged in killing people.
Bush, that's true too, but Bush was actually a very enthusiastic practitioner of the death penalty, and in fact gloated about his use of the death penalty when he was governor of Texas. But Gregoire isn't quite that uncouth about it, but she has been a supporter of the death penalty. But in this particular case, there are a number of mitigating circumstances that the defense is pointing toward in the case of Stenson. But just the fact that it's unfair, the death penalty is inappropriate, is in my mind a pretty good reason for commuting the sentence. So if anybody wants to direct their concerns about this case to Christine Gregoire, I think this week would be an excellent time to do it.
All right. Moving on to national and the economy.
Yeah, the economy stops for no holiday, pretty clearly. This week, the bailout didn't stop for any holiday either. We had early in the week the Citigroup bailout. Late on Sunday, the Treasury announced that they were going to give Citigroup another $20 billion in bailout funds out of that $700 billion that was approved by Congress. That's after already giving them $25 billion from the first round of money that was paid out. The Treasury and the FDIC said that they will guarantee another $250 billion of risky loans, which includes mortgage-backed securities and securities backed by commercial loans as well, including, things like credit card debt. This is called a loss-sharing agreement. Citi will assume the first $29 billion in losses, and then the government will step in and take 90% of the remaining losses that Citigroup has to declare from here on out. So in exchange, the government gets $27 billion in non-voting shares of Citigroup, which pay about an 8% dividend. So again, they're making a high interest loan to Citigroup, which is questionable whether that's actually going to help them or not. Basically, what the Treasury is doing is it's saying that we're giving Citigroup about one more quarter to get things straightened out, and after that, the government's going to step in and assume all or 90% of their losses. It's mind-boggling, especially when you look at last Friday, Citigroup's market value was just $20.5 billion if you were looking at their stock price. That's down from over $270 billion in 2006. So, you know, you might ask, if the whole company was valued at $20.5 billion in terms of their stock price, why didn't the government just step in and take them over, instead of pouring another $20 billion in and then guaranteeing their losses, et cetera? And that's a good question. The answer to that question is that the Bush administration doesn't believe in taking over companies. That would be too much government intervention. Of course, this also points out, too, the peril of allowing banks to become publicly traded companies. Citigroup has said that they value their balance sheet at about $2 trillion. That's their assets that they have. They think that they're worth about $2 trillion. Of course, the stock, you know, investors don't think that. But if that's the case, then they ought to be a private company. They shouldn't be a publicly traded company if it's going to harm them that much. So it really points to the fact that we need really broad and drastic reform of our financial system. Banks pushed really hard in the 80s and 90s to allow the government to allow them to become publicly traded companies, and it's been a failed experiment, and the government should step in and end it. That's good. Of course, that would take a lot.
How do you put the genie back in that bottle?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Because, you know, when you have a publicly traded company, you have thousands of people holding shares. Are you going to force them to sell those shares?
No, I think the way the government should do it is they should just seize the banks and say, you know, shareholders, you don't get anything, basically. Because you could argue that because the value of Citigroup was $20.5 billion on Friday, that you could say, do the same thing with them as you did with Washington Mutual, basically step in and say, you failed, we're taking you over, we're selling your assets, et cetera, we're guaranteeing the deposits up to a certain amount, like we do for a failed bank. And then basically make that bank a private company again, highly regulated by the government. But the federal government claims that Citigroup was too big to fail, and so they're pouring money into it.
So do you remember, was there any specifics that they had to reach when they got that initial $25 billion?
I mean, no, that was part. Remember, we talked about that 2 or 3 weeks ago when the Fed made the first payouts of that money from the bailout package. They just looked at the size of different banks and they said, okay, automatically the top dozen or so banks in the country are going to get, you know, money. And so they gave Citigroup was one of the biggest. They gave them $25 billion.
And they lost like 50,000. Didn't they just like get rid of 50,000 of their workers?
Yeah, they just fired a bunch of people and, you know, they're trying to consolidate. But it's not helping them any because they made all these risky loans.
All right.
Just like everybody else in the banking industry did. And I want to point out too that this all happened during President Bush's watch. You know, sure, a lot of the regulations that had been in place to regulate banks were repealed during the Clinton administration, but there were still active organizations regulating the banking industry. And when Bush came into power, he basically told all the regulators under him, okay, hands off. Everybody from the EPA on down to the SEC, he said, hands off. Let you know, the markets do what the markets do. Let business do what business does. You don't get involved. And that's what happened. The SEC, the FDIC, the Fed, the Treasury, nobody was looking. They basically sent the message of, we're not going to regulate you. And banks just had a holiday, basically. Went in and they made all the profits that they wanted for their shareholders and their top CEOs and top management, and they didn't care about risk and they didn't care about their customers. And now guess who's paying for it? Taxpayers, and their customers are paying for it, and a few of the lower level employees who are getting laid off are paying for it. and almost none of the CEOs and the upper management are. For example, when Washington Mutual was taken over, a lot of their upper management were laid off. The same with Lehman Brothers. They lost a lot of their upper management when you know, they failed. Citigroup just got a bailout from the federal government. It was almost a takeover, not a takeover, which it should have been. And their upper management stays in place. Not a single one of them are losing their jobs. So, and then I want to talk about the other bailout that happened this week. You might call it the bailout of the bailout. Federal Reserve stepped in and said, okay, because the Treasury is reaching the limit of the first $350 billion that they can spend from that $700 billion that Congress approved, to spend the other $350 billion, they'd have to go back to Congress and ask for them to release the funds. The Federal Reserve stepped in and said, okay, we're going to help out by buying $500 billion of mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Banks. So in essence, just taking over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wasn't enough. So, you know, they had to go in and say, okay, we're going to buy $500 billion of mortgage-backed securities from these companies that we have seized. And the Federal Reserve said, okay, we will also buy $100 billion of debt issued by these same organizations. So they've been trying to issue debt securities to get more cash to make loans, which they haven't been able to do. And those first two initiatives of this plan were supposed to bring down mortgage interest rates so that people could refinance, because in spite of all the money being poured into the banking industry, very little of it has been going out the door to help their customers, as I've pointed out before. Most of the banks have been holding on to their cash, and as a result, interest rates have not gone down any, and people are struggling to refinance. So this move did help a little bit with that. Mortgage interest rates went down a half of a percentage point, and a bunch of people rushed to refinance. Unfortunately, the only ones who could refinance are people with good credit and who have equity in their homes, which means that people who took out adjustable rate mortgages or subprime mortgages because they didn't have great credit are still out of luck. Those are the people who really need help, but they still can't get any help from this move. And people who had good credit but bought their house and now are underwater, which means their house is worth less than the amount they owe on it, those people can't refinance either, because they have to have equity in their home before they can take advantage of a refinance. So so that's not helping the majority of the people who need help. A third part of the bailout plan, the Fed said that they will loan $200 billion to large institutional investors. That includes hedge funds, pension funds, and investment companies so that they can...
My heart bleeds for those folks.
Oh, I know. It's a great deal for them. They're getting this $200 billion so they can turn around and buy securities that are backed by auto loans, credit cards, small business loans, and student loans. Basically what you would call commercial loans. It's because commercial loans have been hard to come by and interest rates have been high because the commercial loans are starting to people are starting to default on their commercial loans as well, like their credit cards and so credit card debt and so forth. It turns out that not only were mortgages bundled up into mortgage-backed securities, but student loans were repackaged the same way. Credit card loans were repackaged and sold as securities in the same way. And the market for those has plummeted right along with mortgage-backed securities, and particularly now since people are starting to default on their commercial loans.
You're also starting to see commercial mortgages.
Businesses taking out mortgages to buy business property and storefronts, etc. Retail businesses who took out loans, etc. Those folks are starting to default as well, and that's going to be, I think I talked about that last week, that's going to be a second wave of mortgage defaults coming along. So that third initiative really was an attempt to remove some of the glut of debt from the system. You could look at this whole problem broadly and say the root of the problem is we have a glut of debt. People and companies and the government have all borrowed too much and spent too much, and now we all owe too much. And so you could say that this third attempt was an attempt to remove some of the glut of debt from the public financial system and create demand for more, which doesn't make sense, does it? It really doesn't. It's an attempt to get people to borrow more, to buy more. It's an attempt to boost consumer spending by getting people to borrow even more. Well, you know, really you have to say to get out of a glut of debt, the way you do it is you don't shift the debt from the financial system onto the books of the government in order to make room for more debt in the financial system. The way to get out of it is you have to work yourself out of the hole. Really, if you look at it in terms of personal finance, if you charge too much on your credit card, basically you have to put the credit card in the drawer and you have to start, you know, paying more on, you know, working harder and paying more money to pay off your debt, right? Well, that's not what the Bush administration wants to do. They want to turn back the clock to 2005 or 2006. They want to continue to have cheap money available and people borrowing more and more and spending more and more and more, and that's just going to dig us deeper into the hole.
Yeah, by definition, that kind of a policy is not sustainable because you're basically... The whole appeal of this and the whole reason people got into consumer debt in the first place is because it's like free money. And that's what people want, is free money. But you can't have free money.
There
is no
such thing.
At some point, you have to pay.
Yeah, there is no such
thing. And that's what we're being asked to do now, is pay.
Yeah, although if you're at the Fed level, if you're the Federal Reserve, you might say there is free money. All I have to do is push a button and print more. And that's essentially what the Fed is doing when it does these.
But there's a cost for that, too.
Yes, there is. That's what the Fed is doing with this second sort of bailout of the bailout, is they're just pushing a button and printing more money to pour into the financial system to try to balance out the debt. In other words, try to balance out the debt by throwing in more cash. But there is a risk to that. The more money you print, the more risk of inflation. Now, we talked a little bit about deflation because of the recession, but there's the equal risk. On the other hand, if you pour too much cash in, you get inflation or increasing prices and a glut of money in the system. So there's that risk as well. And there's also the risk of when you keep pouring money down a black hole and you make the problem worse instead of better, essentially hitting sometime next year, having a second wave of these debt defaults hit, and then a third wave, and then a fourth wave. And then after a while, it destroys the credit not only of the American consumer and of American businesses, and destroys a lot of families and in the process, but it also destroys the credit of the U.S. government, which is the only thing that's keeping the economy afloat right now, is the fact that foreign investors and rich people are still buying U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. You don't want them to stop.
Speaking of deflation, this is somewhat off the topic, but I have an economic question that probably a lot of people have. Why is gas under $2 a gallon?
It's because the demand has gone down so far. And I think I talked about this, too, when I talked about during the high gas prices. I talked a little bit about why gas prices were way higher than they needed to be. Because that market has been deregulated as well, and anybody and everybody can invest in futures in the commodities markets. And prices can be run up super high when the fundamentals don't justify it. And then on the reverse, when prices go down, they can plummet way lower than they should be when the fundamentals don't justify it. So that's part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that just demand for energy slows down when you see a global recession, and this is one of the arguments people make for there being a global recession right now, is that commodities prices all across the board have fallen because when people don't have money to spend on anything, they don't buy stuff, and when they don't buy stuff, there's less demand for energy, less demand for raw materials. Unfortunately, one of the things that hasn't gone down much is the price of food, and that's something that there's never a lack of demand for, especially now. So I just want to run through a few of the numbers right now. There were some third quarter reports that came out. Americans' disposable income fell 9.2% in the third quarter. That's the largest drop dating back to when they first started keeping records in 1947. The nation's gross domestic product, the value of all the goods and services produced, also shrank at a 0.5% annual rate in the third quarter. That was much higher than the original estimate of a 0.3% decline, so that has all the economists kind of panicking. What's the impact on average Americans? Well, 36.5 million Americans now live below the poverty line. The poverty line is set at $21,200 per year for a family of four. So the poverty level is set ridiculously low. 36.5 million Americans now live below the poverty line. And that could that number could increase by over 10 million by the end of next year. The number of Americans living on food stamps rose 9.6%, or over 2.6 million, from August 2007, when this crisis first struck, to August 2008. And I'm afraid that's probably going to go up as well.
All right. Moving on to international and the massacre that's currently taking place in Mumbai.
Yeah, it's actually resolved at this point. Commandos stormed in, I guess, this morning Indian time, and killed the last three of the terrorists holed up in a hotel in Mumbai. And now you have to basically tally up the carnage and figure out who is behind this, and sort of what the arc of developments was that led to this. A lot of the media coverage in the United States of this has automatically sort of lumped this in as an Islamic terror, war on terror sort of narrative, particularly since Westerners were among those targeted, although it was certainly not exclusively aimed at Westerners at all. But a lot of the evidence is pointing toward this being fairly homegrown, very specific to the Kashmiri conflict. And the biggest question at this point is whether these were Indian terrorists, whether these were terrorists that were trained and sponsored by the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, which has a history of doing this kind of thing and has their fingerprints all over Kashmiri separatists and their struggles, or whether it was some combination of it. There's some eyewitnesses that were saying that the terrorists were speaking Hindi, which would point to them being Indian rather than Pakistani. Also, the name of the group that
the
Deccan Mujahideen that claim credit for this is a homegrown name, but you know, that could be a smokescreen also. So all that will need to get sorted out over the next few days. But it's going to be very interesting to see what impact this has both on Pakistani Indian relationships, and of course both of those are thanks in part to the United States nuclearly armed nations, and also what this does to the war on terror and terror initiatives in the West. This whole incident is a really good example of unintended consequences, and certainly the United States doesn't have a primary responsibility for this. A lot of this is very specific to the local context of the Kashmiri conflict and Pakistani-Indian relations, but the Bush administration over the last 8 years has poured a lot of money and a lot of arms onto both sides of this conflict. The Indians, of course,
into that region in general.
Yeah. But the Indians, of course, have benefited from a new security agreement, and the United States also signing off on a treaty that makes India a nuclear partner. Pakistan being the proxy for the war on terror, particularly under Musharraf, and not surprisingly, these two age-old enemies have used a lot of that weaponry on each other, and there's been no consequences to this. During the Carter administration, both Pakistan and India were on a sanctions list because of the development of nuclear weapons. That was dropped when Bush came into office, and we've seen some of the result of that in how these two countries are going at each other, and how the extremists on both sides, because there have been abuses by the Indian army in Kashmir, the Hindi nationalists are just as ugly as anything the Islamist movement has ever produced. We see how encouraging the let's you and him fight mentality is paying off in that part of the world.
Yeah, and the fact that the Bush administration has completely repudiated using diplomacy of any kind over anything, is gives a bad example to the rest of the world that it's okay for you to go ahead and attack the other guys. Diplomacy, negotiation, what's that good for? That's not good for anything.
Yeah, and in fact, with the Indian army in Kashmir, the Indian government has specifically cited Bush's doctrine of preemptive attack, of they're harboring terrorists, therefore we can attack them, as a justification for going in illegally.
Mm-hmm. All right. And also this week, the Iraqi parliament had a vote.
Yeah, the Iraqi parliament voted finally on the security pact for U.S. troops to remain in the country. Of course, it was contentious, but the Sunnis got a few. The Sunni delegation was going to withdraw and not vote for the pact. And in order to get together what the government could call a real consensus, they made a couple of they basically gave the Sunnis a couple of things that they wanted that hadn't been in the original agreement. In other words, they said, well, okay, we will stop prosecuting guys that we think were part of the Sunni insurgency, which the Sunnis have been holding out for a while, and the Sunnis wanted to incorporate some of their guys into the security forces, because as a lot of people know who've been following the conflict in Iraq, that the Shiites have pretty much divvied up the security forces among themselves, the police forces and the army as well. And so the Sunnis are saying, look, we want to actually have some of our guys in there so that we won't be subject to repression and reprisals once the U.S. military leaves.
Yeah, one of the other things that was put in response to the opposition to this agreement was a referendum that will be held next July with the Iraqi public on whether they want to see U.S. troops leave later than the 2011 timeline that is in the agreement, which
earlier.
there is overwhelming support publicly for an early withdrawal. But the way the agreement is reached, if the agreement is in fact repudiated by a public vote for an earlier withdrawal, there's still a one-year clause that requires that 1 year's notice be given before the United States leaves. So the 16 months that Obama promised is impossible under this agreement, which the Bush administration is ramming through without either consultation with or approval by Congress.
Yeah, and we'll see how Obama responds to this once he gets into office, whether he says, well, that was the old administration, we're going to cut a new deal, or whether he decides to stick with what the Bush administration has put into place.
Yeah, and the one last thing on this that has not really been mentioned in media coverage is that this is a vast expansion of executive branch powers by having a SOSA, basically a use of force agreement with a foreign country that doesn't go to Congress for approval. And if Congress doesn't formally object to this, and so far the Democratic leaders of Congress have not, it sets a really, really ugly precedent.
All right, and finally, briefly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan and former CIA asset, is now demanding that an agreement for a U.S. and NATO withdrawal, similar to what the security pact represents in Iraq. Otherwise, his threat is that the government of Afghanistan might actually gasp and negotiate with the Taliban, which, in fact, they're already doing secretly, but this would be more public negotiations.
All right. And no events for the week?
Nope. Well, there's certainly things going on, but nothing that rises to the level of let's give it a plug.
All right.
And you can do your part to show what you think ought to happen with the economy by not going out and buying tons and tons of stuff for Christmas.
Yeah, that's a good non-event also.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with local, national, global news. You can find it where you find free publications and newspapers, at bookstores, corners, coffee shops, King County Library System, etc. Or you can go online to www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, anything that you heard on this show or otherwise, give us an email at editorial@eatthestate.org or info@eatthestate.org.